Side 3. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 73. Out over the airwaves, into the society gigs, someday as far as what seeps out hidden speakers in the city elevators and in all the markets, his birds singing to gainsay the man's lullabies, to subvert the groggy wash of the endlessly, gutlessly overdubbed strings. So that prophecy, even up here on rainy Massachusetts Avenue, is beginning these days to work itself out in Cherokee. The Saxes downstairs getting now into some old, really weird shit. If Slothrop follows that harp down the toilet, it'll have to be head first, which is not so good, because it leaves his ass up in the air, helpless, and with Negroes around, that's just what a fella doesn't want. His face down in some fetid unknown darkness and brown fingers strong and sure, all at once undoing his belt, unbuttoning his fly, strong hands holding his legs apart, and he feels the cold Lysol air on his thighs as down come the boxer shorts, too, now, with the colorful bass lures and trout flies on them. He struggles to work himself farther into the toilet hole as dimly up through the smelly water comes the sound of a whole dark gang of awful Negroes come yelling happily into the white men's room, converging on poor, wriggling Slothrop, jiving around the way they do, singing, "Slip the talcum to me, Malcolm." And the voice that replies is who but that red, shoeshine boy who's slicked up Slothrop's black patents a dozen times down on his knees, just popping that rag to beat the band. Now, Red, the very tall, skinny, extravagantly conked redhead Negro shoeshine boy, who's just been read to all the Harvard fellows. Say, Red, any of those sheiks in the drawer? How about another luck-changing phone number there, Red? This Negro, whose true name now halfway down the toilet, gliding down the crack now toward his asshole, chevroning the hairs along like topo lines up a river valley, the true name is Malcolm. And all the black cocks know him. Malcolm, have known him all along. Red Malcolm, the unthinkable nihilist, says, "Good golly, he sure is all asshole, ain't he?" Jeepers, Slothrop, what a position for you to be in, even though he has succeeded in getting far enough down now so that only his legs protrude and his buttocks heave and wallow just under the level of the water like pallid domes of ice. Water splashes, cold as the rain outside, up the walls of the white bowl. "Grab him fo' he gets away. Yowza!" Distant hands clutch after his calves and ankles, snap his garters, and tug at the argyle socks Mom knitted for him to go to Harvard in. But these insulate so well, or he has progressed so far down the toilet by now, that he can hardly feel the hands at all. Then he has shaken them off, left the last Negro touch back up there, and is free, slick as a fish, with his virgin asshole preserved. Now, some folks might say, "Phew, thank God for that." And others, moaning a little, "Aw, shucks." But Slothrop doesn't say much of anything because he didn't feel much of anything. Eh, and there's still no sign of his lost harp. The light down here is dark gray and rather faint. For some time has been aware of shit, elaborately crusted along the sides of this ceramic, or by now iron, tunnel he's in. Shit nothing can flush away, mixed with hard water minerals into a deliberate brown barnacling of his root. Patterns thick with meaning, Burma-shave signs of the toilet world, icky and sticky, cryptic and glyptic. These shapes loom and pass smoothly as he continues on down the long, cloudy waistline, the sounds of Cherokee still pulsing very dimly above, playing him to the sea. He finds he can identify certain traces of shit as belonging definitely to this or that Harvard fellow of his acquaintances. Some of it, too, of course, must be Negro shit, but that all looks alike. Hey, here's that gobbler biddle. Must have been the night we all ate chop suey at Foo's Folly in Cambridge, because there's bean sprouts around here someplace and even a hint of that wild plum sauce. Say, certain senses then do seem to grow sharper. Wow. Foo's Folly. Weepers, that was months ago. Eh, and here's Dumpster Villard. He was constipated that night, wasn't he? It's black shit mean as resin that will someday clarify forever to dark amber. In its blunt, reluctant touches along the wall, which speak the reverse of its own cohesion, he can uncannily, shit-sensitized now, read old agonies inside poor Dumpster, who'd tried suicide last semester. the differential equations that would not weave for him into any elegance, the mother with the low-slung hat and silk knees leaning across Slothrop's table and Sidney's great yellow grill to finish for him his bottle of Canadian ale, the Radcliffe girls who evaded him, the black professionals Malcolm touted him on to who dealt him erotic cruelty by the dollar, up to as much as he could take. Or if Mother's check was late, only a Ford. Gone away upstream, bar relief dumpster lost in the gray light as now Slothrop is going past the sign of Will Stonybloke, of J. Peter Pitt, of Jack Kennedy, the ambassador's son. Say, where the heck is that Jack tonight anyway? If anybody could have saved that harp, betcha Jack could. Slothrop admires him from a distance. He's athletic and kind and one of the most well-liked fellows in Slothrop's class. Sure is daffy about that history, though. Jack. Might Jack have kept it from falling, violated gravity somehow? Here, in this passage to the Atlantic, odors of salt, weed, decay washing to him faintly like the sound of breakers, yes, it seems Jack might have. For the sake of millions of possible blues lines, notes to be bent from the official frequencies, Ben's Slothrop hasn't really the breath to do, not yet, but someday. Well, at least if, when, he finds the instrument, it'll be well soaked in, a lot easier to play. A hopeful thought to carry with you down the toilet. Down the toilet, look at me, what a silly thing to do. Hope nobody takes a pee, yippee dippy dippy doo. At which precise point, there comes this god-awful surge from up the line, noise growing like a tidal wave, a jam-packed wavefront of shit, vomit, toilet paper, and dingleberries, and mind-boggling mosaic, rushing down on panicky Slothrop like an MTA subway train on its own hapless victim. Nowhere to run. Paralyzed, he stares back over his shoulder, a looming wall stringing long tendrils of shit paper behind. The shockwave is on him. Gah! He tries a feeble frog kick at the very last moment, but already the cylinder of waste has wiped him out, dark as cold beef gelatin along his upper backbone, the paper snapping up, wrapping across his lips, his nostrils, everything gone and shit-stinking now, as he has to keep batting micro-turds out of his eyelashes. It's worse than being torpedoed by Japs. The brown liquid tearing along, carrying him helpless. Seems he's been tumbling ass over teakettle, though there's no way to tell in this murky shitstorm, no visual references. From time to time he will brush against shrubbery or perhaps small feathery trees. It occurs to him he hasn't felt the touch of a hard wall since he started to tumble, if that indeed is what he's doing. At some point the brown dusk around him has begun to lighten, like the dawn. Bit by bit his vertigo leaves him. The last wisps of shit paper, halfway back to slurry, go, sad, dissolving away. An eerie light grows on him, a watery and marbled light he hopes won't last for long because of what it seems to promise to show. But contacts are living in these waste regions, people he knows. Inside shells of old, what seem to be fine-packed masonry ruins, weathered cell after cell, many of them roofless. Wood fires burn in black fireplaces, water simmers in rusty institutional-sized lima bean cans, and the steam goes up the leaky chimneys. And they sit about the worn flagstones, transacting some, he can't place it exactly, something vaguely religious. Bedrooms are fully furnished, with lights that turn and glow, velvet hung from walls and ceiling, down to the last ignored blue bead clogged with dust under the cape heart, the last dried spider and complex ruffling of the carpet's nap. The intricacy of these dwellings amazes him. It is a place of sheltering from disaster, not necessarily the flushings of the toilet. These occur here only as a sort of inferred disturbance. Behind this ancient sky, in its corroded evenness of tone, but something else has been terribly at this country, something poor soggy Slothrop cannot see or hear, as if there is a Pearl Harbor every morning, smashing invisibly from the sky. He has toilet paper in his hair, and a fuzzy thick dingleberry lodged up inside his right nostril. Ugh, ugh. Decline and fall works silently on this landscape. No sun, no moon, only a long, smooth sine-waving of the light. It is a negro dingleberry, he can tell. Stubborn as a wintertime booger as he probes for it. His fingernails draw blood. He stands outside all the communal rooms and spaces, outside in his own high desert morning, a reddish-brown hawk, too, hanging up on an air current to watch the horizon. It's cold. The wind blows. He can feel only his isolation. They want him inside there, but he can't join them. Something prevents him. Once inside, it would be like taking some kind of blood oath. They would never release him. There are no guarantees he might not be asked to do something, something so... Now every loose stone, every piece of tinfoil, billet of wood, scrap of kindling or cloth is moving up and down, rising 10 feet, then dropping again to hit the pavement with a sharp clap. The light is thick and water green. All down the streets, debris rises and falls in unison as if at the mercy of some deep regular wave. It's difficult to see any distance through the vertical dance. The drumming on the pavement goes for 11 beats, skips a 12th, begins the cycle over. It is the rhythm of some traditional American tune. The streets are all empty of people. It's either dawn or twilight. Parts of the debris that are metal shine with a hard, nearly blue persistence. Now, don't you remember Red Malcolm up there, that kid with the red devil lie in his hair? Here now is Crutchfield, or Crouchfield, the westward man. Not archetypical westward men, but the only. Understand, there was only one. There was only one Indian who ever fought him. Only one fight, one victory, one loss. And only one president, and one assassin, and one election. True. One of each of everything. You had thought of solipsism and imagined the structure to be populated on your level by only, terribly, one. No count on any other levels. But it proves to be not quite that lonely. Sparse, yes, but a good deal better than solitary. One of each of everything's not so bad. Half an arc's better than none. This Crutchfield here is browned by sun, wind, and dirt against the deep brown slats of the barn or stable wall. He is wood of a different grain and finish. He is good-humored, solid set against the purple mountain slope, and looking half into the sun. His shadow is carried, strained coarsely back through the network of wood inside the stable. Beams, lodge poles, stall uprights, trough trestle work, rafters, wood ceiling slats the sun comes through, blinding empyrean even at this failing hour of the day. There is somebody playing a mouth harp behind an outbuilding, some musical glutton, mouth-sucking giant five-note chords behind the tune of Red River Valley. Down this toilet, they say, you are flushing. Won't you light up and set for a spell? 'Cause the toilet, it ain't going nowhere, and the shit hereabouts sure is swell. Oh, it's the Red River, all right. If you don't believe it, just ask that Red, wherever he may be. Tell you what Red means, FDR's little asshole buddies. They want to take it all away. Women all have hair on their legs. Give it all to them, or they'll blow it up round black iron in the middle of the night, bleeding over Polacks and gray caps, Okies, niggers, yeah, niggers especially. Well, back here, Crutchfield's little pard has just come out of the barn. His little pard of the moment, anyway. Crutchfield has left a string of broken-hearted little pards across this vast alkali plain. One little Phoebe in South Dakota. One little hustler in San Berdu, one little chink run away from the railroad with his ass just as yellow as Fu Manchu. One with the clap and one with a goiter, one with a terminal leprosy. Cripple on the right foot, cripple on the left foot, crippled up both feet, and that makes three. Well, one little fairy, even one bull dyke, one little nigger, one little kike, one red Indian with one buffalo and a buffalo hunter from New Mexico. And on, one of each of everything. He's the white coxman of the Terre Mauvaise, this Crouchfield, doing it with both sexes and all animals except for rattlesnakes. Properly speaking, rattlesnake, since there's only one. But lately he's been having these fantasies about that rattlesnake, too. Fangs just tickling the foreskin, the pale mouth open wide and the horrible joy in the crescent eyes. His little pard of the moment is Wappo, a Norwegian mulatto lad who has a fetish for horsey paraphernalia, likes to be quirt-whipped inside the sweat and leather tack rooms of their wandering, which is 3 weeks old today, pretty long time for a little pard to have lasted. Wappo is wearing chaps of imported gazelle hide that Crutchfield bought for him in Eagle Pass from a faro dealer with a laudanum habit who was crossing the Great Rio forever in the blank furnace of the wild Mexico. Wappo also sports a bandana of the regulation magenta and green. Crutchfield is supposed to have a closet full of these silken scarves back home at Rancho Peligroso, and never rides out into the rock country and riverbed trails without a dozen or two stashed in his saddlebags. This must mean that the one of each rule applies only to forms of life, such as little pards, and not to objects, such as bandanas. And Wappo tops off with a high, shiny opera hat of Japanese silk. Wappo is quite the dandy this afternoon, in fact, as he comes sauntering out from the barn. Ah, Crutchfield, flipping a hand. How nice of you to show up. You knew I'd show up, you little rascal. Shit, that Wappo is such a caution. Always baiting his master in hopes of getting a leather-keen stripe or two across those dusky Afro-Scandinavian buttocks, which combine the Calipigian rondure observed among the races of the Dark Continent with the taut and noble musculature of sturdy Olaf, our blonde northern cousin. But this time, Crutchfield only turns back to watching the distant mountains. Wappo sulks. His top hat reflects the coming Holocaust. What the white man does not have to utter, however casually, is anything like Toro Rojo's gonna be riding in tonight. Both pardoners know about that. The wind bringing them down that raw engine smell ought to be enough for anybody. Oh, God, it's going to be a shootout and bloody as hell. The wind will be blowing so hard, blood will glaze on the north sides of the trees. The redskin will have a dog with him, the only Indian dog in these whole ashen plains. The cur will mix it up with little Wappo and end hung on the meat hook of an open meat stall in the dirt plaza back in Los Madres, eyes wide open, mangy coat still intact, black fleas hopping against the sunlit mortar and stone of the church wall across the square, blood darkened and crusting at the lesion in his neck where Wappo's teeth severed his jugular, and maybe some tendons, for the head dangles to one side. The hook enters in the back, between two vertebrae. Mexican ladies poke at the dead dog, and it sways reluctantly in the forenoon market smell of platanos or frying. Sweet baby carrots from the Red River Valley, trampled raw greens of many kinds, cilantro smelling like animal musk, strong white onions, pineapples fermenting in the sun, about to blow up, great mottled shelves of mountain mushroom. Slothrop moves among the bins and hung cloths, invisible, among horses and dogs, pigs, brown-uniformed militia, Indian women with babies slung in shawls, servants from the pastel houses farther up the hillside. The plaza is seething with life, and Slothrop is puzzled. Isn't there supposed to be only one of each? Answer. Yes. Question. Then one Indian girl. Answer. One pure Indian. One mestiza. One criolla. Then one Yaqui, one Navajo, one Apache. Question. Wait a minute. There was only one Indian to begin with, the one that Crutchfield killed. Answer. Yes. Look on it as an optimization problem. The country can best support only one of each. Question. And what about all the others? Boston, London? The ones who live in cities? Are those people real or what? Answer. Some are real and some aren't. Question. Well, are the real ones necessary or unnecessary? Answer. It depends what you have in mind. Question. Shit, I don't have anything in mind. Answer. We do. For a moment, 10,000 stiffs humped under the snow in the Ardennes take on the sunny Disney field look of numbered babies under white wool blankets, waiting to be sent to blessed parents in places like Newton Upper Falls. It only lasts a moment. Then for another moment, it seems that all the Christmas bells in the creation are about to join in chorus, that all their random pealing will be this one time coordinated in harmony, present with tidings of explicit comfort, feasible joy. But segue into the Roxbury hillside. Snow packs into the arches, the cross-hatchings of his black rubber soles. His arctics clink when he moves his feet. The snow in this slum darkness has the appearance of soot in a negative. It flows in and out of the night. The brick surfaces by daylight. He only sees them in very early dawn, aching inside his overshoes, looking for cabs up and down the hill, are flaming corrosion, dense, deep, fallen upon by frosts again and again, historied in a way he hasn't noticed in Beacon Street. In the shadows, black and white holding in a panda pattern across his face, each of the regions a growth or mass of scar tissue, waits the connection he's traveled all this way to see. The face is as weak as a house dog's, and its owner shrugs a lot. Slothrop. Where is he? Why didn't he show? Who are you? Voice. the kid got busted. And you know me, Slothrop. Remember? I'm never. Slothrop, peering. You? Never? A pause. Did the Kenosha kid? Cryptosam is a proprietary form of stabilized tyrosine developed by IG Farben as part of a research contract with OKW. An activating agent is included which, in the presence of some component of the seminal fluid to date, 1934, unidentified, promotes conversion of the tyrosine into melanin or skin pigment. In the absence of seminal fluid, the cryptosam remains invisible. No other known reagent among those available to operatives in the field will alter cryptosam to visible melanin. It is suggested in cryptographic applications that a proper stimulus be included with the message which will reliably produce tumescence and ejaculation. A thorough knowledge of the addressee's psychosexual profile would seem of invaluable aid. Professor Dr. Laszlo Jampf, Cryptosam, Advertising Brochure, ACFA, Berlin, 1934. The drawing on heavy cream paper under the black letter inscription Geheime Kommandosache is in pen and ink, very finely textured, somewhat after the style of von Behrus or Beardsley. The woman is a dead ringer for Scorpia Mossmoon. The room is one they talked about but never saw, a room they would have liked to live in one day with a sunken pool, a silken tent draped from the ceiling, a DeMille set, really, slender and oiled girls in attendance, a suggestion of midday light coming through from overhead, Scorpia sprawled among fat pillows wearing exactly the corselet of Belgian lace, the dark stockings and shoes he daydreamed about often enough, but never... No, of course, he never told her. He never told anyone. Like every young man growing up in England, he was conditioned to get a hard-on in the presence of certain fetishes, and then conditioned to feel shame about his new reflexes. Could there be somewhere a dossier? Could they somehow have managed to monitor everything he saw and read since puberty? How else would they know? Hush, she whispers. Her fingers stroke lightly her long olive thighs. Bare breasts swell from the top of her garment. Her face is toward the ceiling, but her eyes are looking into Pirate's own, long, narrow with lust, two points of light glittering through the thick lashes. I'll leave him. We'll come here and live. We'll never stop making love. I belong to you. I've known that for a long time. Her tongue licks out over her little sharpened teeth. Her furry quim is at the center of all the light, and there is a taste in his mouth he would feel again. Well, Pirate nearly doesn't make it. Barely gets his cock out of his trousers before he's spurting all over the place. Enough sperm saved, though, to rub over the blank scrap enclosed with the picture. Slowly, then, a revelation through the nacreous film of his seed, in negro brown, comes his message. Put in a simple nihilist transposition whose key words he can almost guess. Most of it he does in his head. There is a time given, a place, a request for help. He burns the message, fallen on him from higher than Earth's atmosphere, salvaged from Earth's prime meridian, keeps the picture, and washes his hands. His prostate is aching. There is more to this than he can see. He has no recourse, no appeal. He has to go over there and bring the operative out again. The message is tantamount to an order from the highest levels. Far away through the rain comes the crack blast of another German rocket, the third today. They hunt the sky like Wotan and his mad army. Pirate's own robot hands begin to search drawers and folders for necessary vouchers and forms. No sleep tonight. Probably no chance even to catch a cup or cigarette en route. Why? In Germany, as the end draws upon us, the incessant walls read, Was tust du für die Front, für den Sieg? Was hast du heute für Deutschland getan? At the White Visitation, the walls read, Ice. Graffiti of ice, the sunless day, glazing the darkening blood brick and terracotta as if the house is to be preserved weatherless in some skin of clear museum plastic. An architectural document, an old-fashioned apparatus whose use is forgotten. ice of varying thickness, wavy, blurred, a legend to be deciphered by lords of the winter, glacists of the region, and argued over in their journals. Uphill toward the sea, snow gathers like light at all windward edges of the ancient abbey, its roof long ago taken at the manic whim of Henry VIII, its walls left to stand and mitigate with saintless window hollows the salt wind, blowing as the seasons replay the grass floor in great cowlicks, green to blonde to snow. From the Palladian house down in its resentful and twilight hollow, this is the only view, the abbey or else gentle, broadly mottled swoops of upland. View of the sea denied, though certain days and tides you can smell it, all your vile ancestry. In 1925, Reg Lefroid, an inmate at the White Visitation, escaped, rushed through the upper town to stand teetering at the edge of the cliff, hair and hospital garment flickering in the wind, the swaying miles of South Coast, pallid chalk, jetties and promenades fading right and left into brine haze. After him came a constable, Stuggles, at the head of a curious crowd. "Don't jump," cries the constable. "I never thought of that," the Freud, continuing to stare out to sea. "Then what are you doing here, eh?" "Wanted to look at the sea," the Freud explains. "I've never seen it. I am, you know, related by blood to the sea." "Oh, aye," Sly Stuggles, edging up on him all the while. "Visiting your relatives, are you? How nice." "I can hear the Lord of the Sea," cries Lefroid in wonder. "Dear me, and what's his name?" Both of them wet-faced, shouting for the wind. "Oh, I don't know," yells Lefroid. "What would be a good name?" "Bert," suggests the constable, trying to remember if it's right hand graps, left hand above elbow, or left hand grasps. Lefroid turns and for the first time sees the man and the crowd. His eyes grow round and mild. "Bert is fine," he says, and steps back into the void. That's all the townsfolk of Ic Regis had from the White Visitation in the way of relief. From summers of staring at the pink or sun-freckled overflow from Brighton, flotsam and jetsam casting each day of wireless history into song, sunsets on the promenade, lens openings forever changing for the sea light, blown now brisk, now sedate about the sky, aspirins for sleep, only Lefroid's leap, that single entertainment, up till the outbreak of this war. At the defeat of Poland, ministerial motorcades were suddenly observed at all hours of the night, putting in at the White Visitation, silent as sloops, exhausts well muffled, chromeless black machinery that shone if there were starlight and otherwise enjoyed the camouflage of a face about to be remembered, but through the act of memory fading too far. Then at the fall of Paris, a radio transmitting station was set up on the cliff, antennas aimed at the continent, themselves heavily guarded and their landlines back mysteriously over the downs to the house, patrolled night and day by dogs specially betrayed, belted, starved into reflex leaps to kill at any human approach. Had one of the very high gone higher, that is, Dottie? Was our side seeking to demoralize the German beast by broadcasting to him random thoughts of the mad, naming for him, also in the tradition of Constable Stuggles, that famous day, the deep, the scarcely seen? The answer is yes, all of the above and more. Ask them at the White Visitation about the master plan of the BBC's eloquent Myron Grunton, whose melted toffee voice has been finding its way for years out the fraying rust boucle of the wireless speakers and into English dreams. Foggy old heads, children at the edges of attention. He's had to keep putting his plan off, at first only a voice alone, lacking the data he really needed, no support, trying to get at the German soul from whatever came to hand. Prisoner of war interrogations, Foreign Office handbooks, the Brothers Grimm, tourist memories of his own, young sleepless, Dawes era flashes, vineyards sunlit very green bearding the south valley slopes of the Rhine. At night in the smoke and worsted cabarets of the capital, long frilled suspenders like rows of carnations, silk stockings highlighted each in one long fine cross-hatching of light. But at last the Americans came in, and the arrangement known as Schaeff, and an amazing amount of money. The scheme is called Operation Blackwing. My, what a careful construction. 5 years in the making. No one could claim it all as his own, not even Grunten. It was General Eisenhower who laid down the controlling guideline, the strategy of truth idea. Something real, Ike insisted on. A hook on the war's pocked execution wall to hang the story from. Pirate Prentice of the SOE came back with the first hard intelligence that there were, indeed, in Germany, real Africans, hereros, ex-colonials from Southwest Africa, somehow active in the secret weapons program. Myron Grunten, inspired, produced on the air one night, completely ad-lib, the passage that found its way into the first Black Wing directive. Germany once treated its Africans like a stern but loving stepfather, chastising them when necessary, often with death. Remember? But that was far away in Sudwest, and since then a generation has gone by. Now the Herero lives in his stepfather's house. Perhaps you, listening, have seen him. Now he stays up past the curfews and watches his stepfather while he sleeps, invisible, protected by the night, which is his own color. What are they all thinking? Where are the Hereros tonight? What are they doing this instant, your dark, secret children? And Black Wing has even found an American, a Lieutenant Slothrop, willing to go under light narcosis to help illuminate racial problems in his own country. An invaluable extra dimension. Toward the end, as more foreign morale data began to come back, Yank pollsters with clipboards and squeaky new shoe packs or galoshes visiting snow-softened, liberated ruins to root out the truffles of truth created, as ancients surmised, during storm in the instant of lightning blast, a contact in American PWD was able to bootleg copies and make them available to the White Visitation. No one is sure who suggested the name Schwarzkommando. Myron Grunten had favored Witten de Heer, that company of spirits who ride the heaths of the sky in furious hunt with great Wotan at their head. But Myron agreed that was more a northern myth. Effectiveness in Bavaria might be less than optimum. They all talk effectiveness, an American heresy, perhaps overmuch at the White Visitation. Loudest of all, usually, is Mr. Pointsman, often using for ammo statistics provided him by Roger Mexico. By the time of the Normandy landing, Pointsman's season of despair was well upon him. He came to understand that the great Continental Pincers was to be, after all, a success, that this war, this state he'd come to feel himself a citizen of, was to be adjourned and reconstituted as a peace. And that, professionally speaking, he'd hardly got a thing out of it. With funding available for all manner of radars, magic torpedoes, aircraft and missiles, where was Pointsman in the scheme of things? He'd had a moment's stewardship, that was all. His abreaction research facility, ARF. Early on, snaring himself a dozen underlings, dog trainer from the variety stage, veterinary student or two, even a major prize, the refugee Dr. Porkievich, who worked with Pavlov himself at the Koltushi Institute, back before the purge trials. Together, the ARF team receive, number, weigh, classify by Hippocratic temperament, cage, and presently experiment on as many as a dozen fresh dogs a week. And there are one's colleagues, co-owners of the book, all now, all those left of the original seven, working in hospitals, handling the battle-fatigued and shell-shocked back from across the channel, and the bomb or rocket-happy this side. They got to watch more abreactions during these days of heavy V bombardment than doctors of an earlier day were apt to see in several lifetimes, and they are able to suggest ever new lines of inquiry. PWE allows a stingy dribble of money, desperate paper whispering down the corporate lattice, enough to get by on, enough that ARF remains a colony to the Metropolitan War, but not enough for nationhood. Mexico's statisticians chart for it drops of saliva, body weights, voltages, sound levels, metronome frequencies, bromide dosages, number of afferent nerves cut, percentages of brain tissue removed, dates and hours of numbing, deafening, blinding castration. Support even comes from Psi Section, a colony dégagé and docile with no secular aspirations at all. Old Brigadier Pudding can live with this spiritualist gang well enough. He's tendencies himself in that direction. But Ned Pointsman, with his constant scheming after more money, Pudding can only stare back at the man, try to be civil. Not as tall as his father, certainly not as wholesome looking. Father was M.O. in Thunder Prod's regiment. Caught a bit of shrapnel in the thigh at Polygon Wood. Lay silent for 7 hours before they... Without a word before, in that mud, that terrible smell. And, yes, Polygon Wood, or was that... Who was the ginger-haired chap who slept with his hat on? Come back. Now Polygon Wood, but it's fluttering away. Fallen trees, dead, smooth gray, swirling grain of tree like frozen smoke. Ginger, thunder. No use, no bleeding use. It's gone, another, oh dear. The old brigadier's age is uncertain, though he must be pushing 80. Reactivated in 1940, set down in a new space not only of battlefield, where the front each day or hour changes like a noose, like the gold-lit borders of consciousness. Perhaps, though it oughtn't to get too sinister here, exactly like them. Better than like a noose. But also of the war state itself, its very structure. Pudding finds himself wondering at times aloud and in the presence of subordinates what enemy disliked him enough to assign him to political warfare. One is supposed to be operating in concert, yet too often in amazing dissonance. With other named areas of the war, colonies of that mother city mapped wherever the enterprise is systematic death. PWE laps over onto the Ministry of Information, the BBC European Service, the Special Operations Executive, the Ministry of Economic Warfare, and the FO Political Intelligence Department at Fitzmaurice House, among others. When the Americans came in, their OSS, OWI, and Army Psychological Warfare Department had also to be coordinated with. Presently, there arose the Joint SHAFE, Psychological Warfare Division, PWD, reporting direct to Eisenhower, and to hold it all together, a London Propaganda Coordinating Council, which has no real power at all. Who can find his way about this lush maze of initials, arrows solid and dotted, boxes big and small, names printed and memorized? Not Ernest Pudding. That's for the new chaps with their little green antennas out for the usable emanations of power, versed in American politics, knowing the difference between the New Dealers of OWI and the Eastern and moneyed Republicans behind OSS. Keeping brain dossiers on latencies, weaknesses, tea-taking habits, erogenous zones of all who might someday be useful. Ernest Pudding was brought up to believe in a literal chain of command, as clergymen of earlier centuries believed in the chain of being. The newer geometries confuse him. His greatest triumph on the battlefield came in 1917, in the gassy Armageddonite filth of the Ypres salient, where he conquered a bite of no man's land some 40 yards at its deepest, with a wastage of only 70% of his unit. He was pensioned off around the beginning of the Great Depression, went to sit in the study of an empty house in Devon, surrounded by photos of old comrades, none of whose gazes quite met one's own, there to go at a spot of combinatorial analysis, that favorite pastime of retired army officers with a rattling, intense devotion. It occurred to him to focus his hobby on the European balance of power because of whose long pathology he had labored deeply, all hope of waking lost in the nightmare of Flanders. He started in on a mammoth work entitled Things That Can Happen in European Politics. Begin, of course, with England. First, he wrote, Bereshith, as it were, Ramsay MacDonald can die. By the time he went through resulting party alignments and possible permutations of cabinet posts, Ramsay MacDonald had died. Never make it, he found himself muttering at the beginning of each day's work. It's changing out from under me. Oh, dodgy, very dodgy. When it had changed as far as German bombs falling on England, Brigadier Pudding gave up his obsession and again volunteered his services to his country. Had he known at the time it would mean the white visitation? Not that he'd expected a combat assignment, you know, but wasn't there something mentioned about intelligence work? Instead, he found a disused hospital for the mad, a few token lunatics, an enormous pack of stolen dogs, cliques of spiritualists, vaudeville entertainers, wireless technicians, Quaists, Uspenskayans, Skinnerites, lobotomy enthusiasts, Dale Carnegie zealots, all exiled by the outbreak of war from pet schemes and manias damned, had the peace prolonged itself to differing degrees of failure, but their hopes now focusing on Brigadier Pudding and possibilities for funding. More hope than pre-war that underdeveloped province ever offered. Pudding could only respond by adopting rather an Old Testament style with everyone, including the dogs, and remaining secretly baffled and hurt by what he imagined as treachery high inside staff. Snowlight comes in through tall, many-paned windows. A dark day, a light burning only here and there among the brown offices. Subalterns encrypt blindfolded subjects called Zener deck guesses to hidden microphones. Waves. Waves. Cross. Star. While someone from Psy section records them from a speaker down in the cold basement. Secretaries in woolen shawls and rubber galoshes shiver with the winter cold being inhaled through the madhouse's many crevices, their typewriter keys chattery as their pearlies. Maud Chilkis, who looks from the rear rather like Cecil Beaton's photograph of Margot Asquith, sits dreaming of a bun and a cup of tea. In the ARF wing, the stolen dogs sleep, scratch, recall shadowy smells of humans who may have loved them, listen undrooling to Ned Pointsman's oscillators and metronomes. The drawn shades allow only mild passages of light from outdoors. Technicians are moving behind the thick observation window, but their robes, greenish and submarine through the glass, flutter more slowly, less brightly. A numbness has taken over, or a felt darkening. The metronome at 80 per second breaks out in wooden echoes, and dog Vanya, bound atop the test stand, begins to salivate. All other sounds are damped severely. The beams underpinning the lab, smothered in sand-filled rooms, sandbags, straw, uniforms of dead men occupying the spaces between the windowless walls, where the country bedlamites sat around, scowling, sniffing nitrous oxide, giggling, weeping at an E major chord modulating to a G sharp minor, now are cubicle deserts, stand rooms, keeping the metronome sovereign here in the lab, behind the iron doors, closed hermetically. The duct of dog Vanya's submaxillary gland was long ago carried out the bottom of his chin through an incision and sutured in place, leading saliva outside to the collecting funnel, fixed there with the traditional orange Pavlovian cement of rosin, iron oxide, and beeswax. Vacuum brings the secretion along through shining tube work to displace a column of light red oil moving to the right along a scale marked off in drops, an arbitrary unit, probably not the same as the actually fallen drops of 1905 of St. Petersburg. But the number of drops for this lab and dog Vanya and the metronome at 80 is each time predictable. Now that he has moved into equivalent phase, the first of the transmarginal phases, a membrane hardly noticeable stretches between dog Vanya and the outside. Inside and outside remain just as they were, but the interface, the cortex of dog Vanya's brain, is changing in any number of ways, and that is the really peculiar thing about these transmarginal events. It no longer matters now how loudly the metronome ticks. A stronger stimulus no longer gets a stronger response. The same number of drops flow or fall. The man comes and removes the metronome to the farthest corner of his muffled room. It is placed inside a box beneath a pillow with the machine-sewn legend Memories of Brighton, but the drops do not fall off. Then played into a microphone and amplifier so that each tick fills the room up like a shout, but the drops do not increase. Every time, the clear saliva pushes the red line over only to the same mark, the same number of drops. Webley Silvernail and Rollo Grost go sneaky-peeting away down the corridors, nipping into people's offices to see if there are any smokable fag ends to be looted. Most offices right now are empty, All personnel with the patience or masochism for it are going through a bit of ritual with the doddering brigadier. That old man has no shame, Gyeza Rozhavolgi, another refugee and violently anti-Soviet, which creates a certain strain with ARF. Flicking his hands up Brigadier Puddingward in gay despair, the lilting Hungarian gypsy whisper bashing like tambourines all around the room, provoking in one way or another everyone here except for the aged brigadier himself, who just goes rambling on from the pulpit of what was a private chapel once, back there on the maniac side of the 18th century, and is now a launching platform for the weekly briefings. A most amazing volley of senile observations, office paranoia, gossip about the war, which might or might not include violations of security, reminiscences of Flanders, the coal boxes in the sky coming straight down on you with a roar, the drum fire so milky and luminous on his birthday night, the wet surfaces in the shell craters for miles giving back one bleak autumn sky. What Haig, in the richness of his wit, once said at mess about Lieutenant Sassoon's refusal to fight, the gunners in springtime in their flowing green robes. Roadsides of poor rotting horses just before apricot sunrise. The 12 spokes of a stranded artillery piece, a mud clock, a mud zodiac, clogged and crusted as it stood in the sun, its many shades of brown. The mud of Flanders gathered into the curd-clumped, mildly jellied textures of human shit, piled, duck-boarded, trenched, and shell-pocked leagues of shit in all directions. Not even the poor blackened stump of a tree, and the old blithering gab artist tries to shake the cherrywood pulpit here, as if that had been the worst part of the whole Passe de la horror, that absence of vertical interest. On he goes, gabbing, gabbing, recipes for preparing beets in 100 tasty ways, or such cucurbitaceous improbabilities as Ernest Pudding's gourd surprise. Yes, there is something sadistic about recipes with surprise in the title. Chap who's hungry wants to just eat, you know, not be surprised, really, just wants to bite into the side, the old potato, and be reasonably sure there's nothing inside but potato, you see. Certainly not some clever nutmeg surprise, some mashed pulp all magenta with pomegranates or something. Well, but this is just the doubtful sort of joke that Brigadier Pudding loves to play. How he's chuckled as unsuspecting dinner guests go knifing into his notorious toad-in-the-hole, through the honest Yorkshire batter into, ugh, what is it? A beet rissolet? A stuffed beet rissolet? Or perhaps today some lovely pureed samphire, reeking of the sea, which he obtains once a week from the same fat fishmonger's son wheeling his bicycle, puffing, up the chalk-white cliff. None of these odd vegetable rissolets do resemble any ordinary toad, but rather the depraved, half-sentient creatures that young chaps from King's Road have affairs with in limericks. Pudding has thousands of these recipes and no shame about sharing any of them with the lot at Pisces, along with, later in the weekly soliloquy, a line or two, 8 bars from Would You Rather Be a Colonel with an Eagle on Your Shoulder or a Private with a Chicken on Your Knee? Then perhaps a lengthy recitation of all his funding difficulties, all dating back to long before the emergence of even the Electra House group, letter feuds he has carried on in the Times with critics of Haig. And they all sit there, in front of the very high, blacked, lead-crossed windows, allowing him his folly, the dog people skulking over in one corner, passing notes and leaning to whisper, they plot, sleeping or afoot, they never let up. The Psi-section lot clear over the other side of the room, as if we have a parliament of some kind here. Everyone for years has occupied his own unique pew seat and angle in to the ravings of reddish and liver-spotted Brigadier Pudding, with the other persuasions in exile spread between these two wings, the balance of power, if any power existed, at the White Visitation. Dr. Rozhavolgi feels that there well might, if the fellows play their cards right. The only issue now is survival. On through the awful interface of VE Day, on into the bright new post-war with senses and memories intact. Pisces must not be allowed to go down under the hammer with the rest of the bawling herd. There must arise, and damned soon, able to draw them into a phalanx, a concentrated point of light, some leader or program powerful enough to last them across who knows how many years of post-war. Dr. Rojavolgi tends to favor a powerful program over a powerful leader, maybe because this is 1945. It was widely believed in those days that behind the war, all the death, savagery, and destruction, lay the Führer principle. But if personalities could be replaced by abstractions of power, if techniques developed by the corporations could be brought to bear, might not nations live rationally? One of the dearest post-war hopes, that there should be no room for a terrible disease like charisma, that its rationalization should proceed while we had the time and resources. Isn't that what's really at stake for Dr. Rojavolgi here in this latest scheme centered on the figure of Lieutenant Slothrop? All the psychological tests in the subject's dossier, clear back to his college days, indicate a diseased personality. Rosie slaps the file with his hand for emphasis. The staff table shudders. For example, his Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory is tremendously lopsided, always in favor of the psychopathic and the unwholesome. But the Reverend Dr. Paul de la Nuit is not fond of the MMPI. Rosie, are there scales for measuring interpersonal traits? Hawk's nose probing, probing eyes lowered in politic meekness. Human values? Trust, honesty, love? Is there, forgive me the special pleading, a religious scale by any chance? No way, Padre. The MMPI was developed about 1943, in the very heart of the war. Allport and Vernon's study of values, the Bernreuther inventory as revised by Flanagan in 35, tests from before the war, seem to Paul de la Nuit more humane. All the MMPI appears to test for is whether a man will be a good or bad soldier. Soldiers are much in demand these days, Reverend Doctor, murmurs Mr. Pointsman. I only hope that we don't put too much emphasis on his MMPI scores. It seems to me very narrow. It omits large areas of the human personality. Precisely why, leaps Rojavolgi. We are now proposing to give Slothrop a completely different sort of test. We are now designing for him a so-called projective test. The most familiar example of the type is the Rorschach ink blot. The basic theory is that when given an unstructured stimulus, some shapeless blob of experience, the subject will seek to impose structure on it. How he goes about structuring this blob will reflect his needs, his hopes, will provide us with clues to his dreams, fantasies, the deepest regions of his mind. Eyebrows going a mile a minute, extraordinarily fluid and graceful hand gestures, resembling, most likely it is deliberate, and who can blame Rosie for trying to cash in, those of his most famous compatriot, though there are the inevitable bad side effects. Staff who swear they've seen him crawling headfirst down the north facade of the White Visitation, for example. So we are really quite in agreement, Reverend Doctor. A test like the MMPI is in this respect not adequate. It is a structured stimulus. The subject can falsify consciously or repress unconsciously. But with a projective technique, nothing he can do, conscious or otherwise, can prevent us from finding what we wish to know. We are in control. He cannot help himself. Must say, it doesn't sound like your cup of tea, Pointsman, smiles Dr. Aaron Throster. Your stimuli are more the structured sort, aren't they?
Let's say I find a certain shameful fascination.
Let's not. Don't tell me you're going to keep your fine Pavlovian hand completely out of this.
Well, not completely, Throster, no. Since you've brought it up, we also happen to have in mind a very structured stimulus.
Same one, in fact, that got us interested to begin with. We want to expose Slothrop to the German rocket. Overhead, On the molded plaster ceiling, Methodist versions of Christ's kingdom swarm. Lions cuddle with lambs. Fruit spills lushly and without pause into the arms and about the feet of gentlemen and ladies, swains and milkmaids. No one's expression is quite right. The wee creatures leer. The fiercer beasts have a drugged or sedated look, and none of the humans have any eye contact at all. The ceilings of the white visitation aren't the only erratic thing about the place, either. It is a classic folly, all right. The buttery was designed as an Arabian harem in miniature, for reasons we can only guess at today, full of silks, fretwork, and peepholes. One of the libraries served, for a time, as a wallow. The floor dropped 3 feet and replaced with mud up to the thresholds for giant Gloucestershire old spots to frolic, oink, and cool their summers in, to stare at the shelves of buckram books and wonder if they'd be good eating. Whig eccentricity is carried in this house to most unhealthy extremes. The rooms are triangular, spherical, walled up into mazes. Portraits, studies, and genetic curiosity gape and smirk at you from every vantage. The WCs contain frescoes of Clive and his elephants stomping the French at Plassy, fountains that depict Salome with the head of John, water gushing out ears, nose, and mouth. Floor mosaics in which are tessellated together different versions of Homo monstrosus, an interesting preoccupation of the time. Cyclops, humanoid giraffe, centaur repeated in all directions. Everywhere are archways, grottos, plaster floral arrangements, walls hung in threadbare velvet or brocade. Balconies give out at unlikely places, overhung with gargoyles whose fangs have fetched not a few newcomers nasty cuts on the head. Even in the worst rains, the monsters only just manage to drool. The rainpipes feeding them are centuries out of repair, running crazed over slates and beneath eaves, past cracked pilasters, dangling cupids, terracotta facing on every floor, along with belvederes, rusticated joints, pseudo-Italian columns, looming minarets, leaning crooked chimneys. From a distance, no two observers, not matter how close they stand, see quite the same building in that orgy of self-expression, added to by each succeeding owner until the present war's requisitioning. Topiary trees line the drive for a distance before giving way to larch and elm. Ducks, bottles, snails, angels, and steeplechase riders, they dwindle down the metalled road into their fallow silence, into the shadows under the tunnel of sighing trees. The sentry, a dark figure in white webbing, stands port-arms in your masked headlamps, and you must halt for him. The dogs, engineered and lethal, are watching you from the woods. Presently, as evening comes on, a few bitter flakes of snow begin to fall. Better behave yourself, or we'll send you back to Dr. Yumpf. When Yumpf conditioned him, he threw away the stimulus. Looks like Dr. Yumpf's been to see your little thing today, hasn't he? Neil Nosepicker's Book of 50,000 Insults, Section 6.72, Awful Offspring. The Nayland Smith Press, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1933. Pudding. But isn't this... Pointsman. Sir? Pudding. Isn't it all rather shabby, Pointsman, meddling with another man's mind this way? Pointsman. Brigadier, we're only following in a long line of experiment and questioning Harvard University, the U.S. Army. Hardly shabby institutions. Pudding. We can't, Pointsman. It's beastly. Pointsman. But the Americans have already been at him, don't you see? It's not as if we're corrupting a virgin or something. Pudding. Do we have to do it because the Americans do it? Must we allow them to corrupt us? Back around 1920, Dr. Laszlo Yumpf opined that if Watson and Rayner could successfully condition their infant Albert into a reflex horror of everything furry, even of his own mother in a fur boa, then Yumpf could certainly do the same thing for his infant Tyrone and the baby's sexual reflex. Yumpf was at Harvard that year, visiting from Darmstadt. It was in the early part of his career, before he phased into organic chemistry, to be as fateful a change of field as Kekulé's own famous switch into chemistry from architecture a century before. For the experiment, he had a slender grant from the National Research Council under a continuing NRC program of psychological study which had begun during the World War when methods were needed for selecting officers and classifying draftees. Shoestring funding may have been why Yam, for his target reflex, chose an infant hard-on. Measuring secretions, as Pavlov did, would have meant surgery. Measuring fear, the reflex Watson chose, would have brought in too much subjectivity. What's fear? How much is a lot? Who decides when it's on the spot in the field and there isn't time to go through the long, slow process of referring it up to the fear board? Instrumentation just wasn't available in those days. The best he might have done was the Larson-Keeler three-variable lie detector, but at the time it was still only experimental. But a hard-on, that's either there or it isn't. Binary, elegant. The job of observing it can even be done by a student. Unconditioned stimulus equals stroking penis with antiseptic cotton swab. Unconditioned response equals hard-on. Conditioned stimulus equals X. Conditioned response equals hard-on whenever X is present. Stroking is no longer necessary. All you need is that X. X? Well, what's X? Why, it's the famous mystery stimulus that's fascinated generations of behavioral psychology students, is what it is. The average campus humor magazine carries 1.05 column inches per year on the subject, which ironically is the exact mean length Yamph reported for infant T's erection. Now, ordinarily, according to tradition in these matters, the little sucker would have been deconditioned. Yamph would have, in Pavlovian terms, extinguished the hard-on reflex he'd built up before he let the baby go. Most likely he did. But, as Ivan Petrovich himself said, not only must we speak of partial or of complete extinction of a conditioned reflex, but we must realize that extinction can proceed beyond the point of reducing a reflex to zero. We cannot therefore judge the degree of extinction only by the magnitude of the reflex or its absence, since there can still be a silent extinction beyond the zero. Italics are Mr. Pointsman's. Can a conditioned reflex survive in a man, dormant, over 20 or 30 years? Did Dr. Yamph extinguish only to zero? Wait till the infant showed zero hard-ons in the presence of stimulus X, and then stop? Did he forget or ignore the silent extinction beyond the zero? If he ignored it, why? Did the National Research Council have anything to say about that? When Slothrop was discovered, late in 1944, by the White Visitation, though many there have always known him as the famous infant Tyrone, like the New World, different people thought they'd discovered different things. Roger Mexico thinks it's a statistical oddity, but he feels the foundations of that discipline trembling a bit now, deeper than oddity ought to drive. Odd, odd, odd. Think of the word. Such white finality in its closing clap of tongue. It implies moving past the tongue stop, beyond the zero, and into the other realm. Of course, you don't move past, but you do realize intellectually that's how you ought to be moving. Rollo Grost thinks it's precognition. Slothrop is able to predict when a rocket will fall at a particular place. His survival to date is evidence he's acted on advance information and avoided the area at the time the rocket was supposed to fall. Dr. Grost is not sure how or even if sex comes into it. But Edwin Treacle, that most Freudian of psychical researchers, thinks Slothrop's gift is psychokinesis. Slothrop is, with the force of his mind, causing the rockets to drop where they do. He may not be physically highballing them about the sky, but maybe he is fooling with the electrical signals inside the rocket's guidance system. However he's doing it, sex does come into Dr. Treacle's theory. He subconsciously needs to abolish all trace of the sexual other whom he symbolizes on his map, most significantly, as a star, that anal sadistic emblem of classroom success which so permeates elementary education in America. It's the map that spooks them all, the map Slothrop's been keeping on his girls. The stars fall in a Poisson distribution just like the rocket strikes on Roger Mexico's map of the robot blitz. But, well, it's a bit more than the distribution. The two patterns also happen to be identical. They match up square for square. The slides that Teddy Bloat's been taking of Slothrop's map have been projected onto Roger's, and the two images, girl stars and rocket strike circles, demonstrated to coincide. Helpfully, Slothrop has dated most of his stars. A star always comes before its corresponding rocket strike. The strike can come as quickly as 2 days or as slowly as 10. The mean lag is about 4.5 days. Suppose, Pointsman argues, that Strobe's stimulus X was some loud noise, as it was in the Watson-Rayner experiment. Suppose that, in Slothrop's case, the hard-on reflex wasn't completely extinguished. In that case, he ought to be getting one on at any loud noise that's preceded by the same kind of ominous build-up he would have found in Yamp's lab, as dogs to this day find in Pointsman's own lab. The points to the V1. Any doodle close enough to make him jump ought to be giving him an erection. The sound of the motor razzing louder and louder, then the cutoff and silence, suspense building up, then the explosion. Boing, a hard-on. But oh no, Slothrop instead only gets erections when this sequence happens in reverse. Explosion first, then the sound of approach, the V2. But the stimulus, somehow, must be the rocket. Some precursor wraith, some rocket's double present for Slothrop in the percentage of smiles on a bus. Menstrual cycles being operated upon in some mysterious way. What does make the little doxies do it for free? Are there fluctuations in the sexual market? In pornography or prostitutes, perhaps tying into prices on the stock exchange itself that we clean living lot know nothing about? Does news from the front affect the itch between their pretty thighs? Does desire grow directly or inversely as the real chance of sudden death, damn it, what cue, right in front of our eyes that we haven't the subtlety of heart to see? But if it's in the air, right here, right now, then the rockets follow from it 100% of the time. No exceptions. When we find it, we'll have shown again the stone determinacy of everything, of every soul. There will be precious little room for any hope at all. You can see how important a discovery like that would be. They walk down past the snow-drifted kennel runs. Pointsman in Glastonbury's and fawn-colored British warm. Mexico wearing a scarf Jessica's lately knitted him, whipping landward a scarlet dragon's tongue. This day the coldest so far of the winter, 39 degrees of frost. Down to the cliffs, faces freezing, down to the deserted beach. Waves run up, slide away to leave great crescents of ice, fine as skin and dazzling in the weak sunlight. The boots of the two men crunch through to sand or shingle, the very bottom of the year. They can hear the guns in Flanders today, all the way across the channel on the wind. The abbey's ruin stands gray and crystal up on the cliff. Last night, in the house at the edge of the stay-away town, Jessica, snuggling, afloat, just before sleep was to take them, whispered, "Roger, what about the girls?" That was all she said. But it brought Roger wide awake, and bone-tired as he was, he lay staring for another hour, wondering about the girls. Now, knowing he ought to let it go, "Pointsman, what if Edwin Treacle is right, that it's P.K.? What if Slothrop's not even consciously making them fall where they do?" "Well, you lot'd have something then, wouldn't you? But why should he, if they are falling wherever he's been? Perhaps he hates women." "I'm serious. Mexico, are you actually worried?" "I don't know. Perhaps I wondered if it might tie in any way, with your ultra-paradoxical phase. Perhaps I want to know what you're really looking for." Above them now throb a flight of B-17s, bound somewhere uncommon today, well out of the usual corridors of flight. Behind these fortresses, the undersides of the cold clouds are blue, and their smooth billows are veined in blue, elsewhere touched with grayed-out pink or purple. Wings and stabilizers are shadowed underneath in dark gray. The shadows softly feather lighter up around curves of fuselage or nacelle. Spinners emerge from hooded dark inside the cowlings, spinning props invisible, the light of the sky catching all vulnerable surfaces a uniform bleak gray. The planes drone along, stately, up in the zero sky, shedding frost as it builds, sowing the sky behind in white ice furrows, their own color matching certain degrees of cloud. All the tiny windows and openings in soft blackness, the perspex nose shining back forever warped and streaming cloud and sun. Inside it is black obsidian. Pointsman has been talking about paranoia and the idea of the opposite. He has scribbled in the book exclamation points and how trues all about the margins of Pavlov's open letter to Janet concerning the sentiment d'emprise and of chapter 55, an attempt at a physiological interpretation of obsessions and of paranoia. He can't help this bit of rudeness, although the agreement among the seven owners was not to mark up the book. It was too valuable for that sort of thing. They'd had to put in a guinea apiece. It was sold him on the sly, in the dark, during a Luftwaffe raid. Most existing copies had been destroyed in their warehouse early in the Battle of Britain. Pointsman never even saw the seller's face, the man vanishing into the hoarse auditory dawn of the all-clear, leaving the doctor and the book, the dumb sheaf already heating up, moistening in his tight hand. Yes, it might have been a rare work of erotica, certainly that coarse handset look to the type. The crudities in phrasing, as if Dr. Horsley Gant's odd translation were in cipher, the plain text listing shameful delights, criminal transports. And how much of the pretty victim straining against her bonds does Ned Pointsman see in each dog that visits his test stands? And aren't scalpel and probe as decorative, as fine extensions as whip and cane? Surely the volume preceding the book, the first 41 lectures, came to him at age 28 like a mandate from the submontane Venus he could not resist. To abandon Harley Street for a journey more and more deviant, deliciously on into a labyrinth of conditioned reflex work in which only now, 13 years along the clue, he's beginning to circle back, trip across old evidence of having come that path before, here and there to confront consequences of his younger total embrace. But she did warn him, did she not? Was he ever listening? Of the deferred payment in its full amount. Venus and Ariadne. She seemed worth any price, the labyrinth looking in those days too intricate for them, the twilight pimps who made the arrangement between a version of himself, a crypto pointsman, and his fate. Too varied, he thought then, ever to find him in. But he knows now, too far in, preferring not to face it just yet, he knows that they only wait, stone and sure, these agents of the syndicate she must also pay, wait in the central chamber as he draws closer. They own everything. Ariadne, the Minotaur, even Pointsman fears himself. He gets flashes of them these days, naked, athletes poised and breathing about the chamber, terrible penises up mineral as their eyes, which glisten with frost or flakes of mica, but not with lust or for him. It's only a job they have. Pierre Janet, sometimes a man talked like an Oriental mystic. He had no real grasp of the opposites. The act of injuring and the act of being injured are joined in the behavior of the whole injury, speaker and spoken of, master and slave, virgin and seducer, each pair most conveniently coupled and inseparable. The last refuge of the incorrigible, lazy Mexico is just sort of yang yin rubbish. One avoids all manner of unpleasant lab work that way, but what has one said? I don't want to get into a religious argument with you. Absence of sleep has Mexico more cranky than usual. But I wonder if you people aren't a bit too, well, strong on the virtues of analysis. I mean, once you've taken it all apart, fine, I'll be first to applaud your industry, but other than a lot of bits and pieces lying about, what have you said? It isn't the sort of argument Pointsman relishes either, but he glances sharply at this young anarchist in his red scarf. Pavlov believed that the ideal, the end we all struggle toward in science, is the true mechanical explanation. He was realistic enough not to expect it in his lifetime,
or in several lifetimes more, but his hope was for a long, better and better approximations. His faith, ultimately, lay in a pure physiological basis for the life of the psyche, no effect without cause, and a clear train of linkages. It's not my fault, of course, Mexico honestly wishing not to offend the man, but really. But there's a feeling about that cause and effect may have been taken as far as it will go. That for science to carry on at all, it must look for a less narrow, a less sterile set of assumptions. The next great breakthrough may come when we have the courage to junk cause and effect entirely and strike off at some other angle. No, not strike off, regress. You're 30 years old, man. There are no other angles. There is only forward, into it, or backward. Mexico watches the wind tugging at the skirts of Pointsman's coat. A gull goes screaming away sidewise along the frozen berm. The chalk cliffs rear up above, cold and serene as death. Early barbarians of Europe who ventured close enough to this coast saw these white barriers through the mist and knew then where their deed had been taken to. Pointsman has turned now, and, oh God, he is smiling. There is something so ancient in its assumption of brotherhood that, not now, but a few months from now, with spring prevailing and the war in Europe ended, Roger will remember the smile. It will haunt him as the most evil look he has ever had from a human face. They've paused in their walking. Roger stares back at the man. The anti-Mexico. Idiopposite themselves, but on winter hemisphere, ruinous mosaic, outward into the waste, from the sheltering city, visible only to those who eyes in the distance, riders. We both have Slothrop, is what Pointsman has just said. Pointsman, what are you expecting out of this, besides glory, I mean? No more than Pavlov. A physiological basis for what seems very odd behavior. I don't care which of your PRS categories it may fit into. Oddly enough, none of you's even suggested telepathy. Perhaps he's tuned in to someone over there, someone who knows the German firing schedule ahead of time. And I don't care if it's some terrible Freudian revenge against his mother for trying to castrate him or something. I am not grandiose, Mexico. I am modest, methodical, humble. I have set myself limitations in this. I have only the reversal of rocket sounds to go on. His clinical histal conditioning, perhaps to auditory stimuli, and what appears to be a reversal of cause and effect. I'm not as ready as you to junk cause and modifying, so... But what are you after? You've seen his MMPI, his F-scale. Falsifications, distorted thought processes. The scores show it clearly. He's pathically deviant, obsessive, a latent paranoiac. Well, Pavlov believed that obsessions and paranoid delusions were a result of certain, call them cells, neurons, on the mosaic of the brain being excited to the level where, through reciprocal induction, all the area around becomes inhibited. One bright, burning point surrounded by darkness. Darkness it has, in a way, called up. Cut off, bright point, perhaps to the end of the patient's life, from all other ideas, sensations, self-criticisms that might temper its aim, restore it to me. He called point of pathological inertia. We're working right now with a dog. He's been through the equivalent phase where any stimulus, strong or weak, calls up exactly the same number of saliva drops. And on through the paradoxical phase, strong stimuli getting weak responses and vice versa. Yesterday we got him to go ultra-paradoxical, beyond. When we turn on the metronome that used to stand for food, that once made dog Vanya drool like a fountain, now he turns away. When we shut off the metronome, oh, then he'll turn to it, sniff, try to lick it, bite it, seek in the silence for the stimulus that is not there. Pavlov thought that all the diseases of the mind could be explained eventually by the ultra-paradoxical phase, the pathologically inert points on the cortex, the confusion of ideas of the opposite.
He died at the very threshold of putting these things on an experimental basis. I live. I have the funding and the time and the will. Slothrop is a strong imperturbable. It won't be easy to send him into any of the three phases. We may finally have to starve, terrorize. I don't know. It needn't come to that. But I will find his spots of inertia. I will find what they are if I have to open up his damned skull and how they are isolated and perhaps solve the mystery of why the rockets are... Though I admit that was more of a sop to get your support. Why?
A bit uneasy there, Mexico.
Why do you need me?
I don't know, but I do.
You're obsessed. Mexico.
Standing very still, seaward half of his face seeming to have aged 50 years in the instant, watching the tide of 3 full times leave behind its sterile film of ice.
Help me.
I can't help anyone, Roger thinks.
Why is he so tempted?
It's dangerous and perverse. He does want to help. He feels the same unnatural fear of Slothrop that Jessica does. What about the girls? It may be his loneliness in Psi's section, in the precision he can't in his heart share, nor quite abandon, their faith, even smileless gloamings, that there must be more beyond the senses, beyond death, beyond the probabilities that are all Roger has to believe in. Oh, Jessie. His face against her bare, sleeping, intricately boned and tendoned back. I'm out of my depth in this. The water and the coarse seagrass, a long stretch of pipe and barbed wire rings in the wind. The black latticework is propped up by longer slanting braces, lances pointing out to sea. An abandoned and mathematical look, stripped to the force vectors holding it where it is, doubled up in behind another, moving as pointsmen and Mexico begin to move again, backward in thick moiré, heated uprights in parallax, repeated diagonals, and the snarls of wire below interfering more at random. Far away, where it curves into the haze, the openwork wall goes green. After last night's fall, each line of the black scrawl was etched in white. But today, wind and have blown the dark iron bare again, salted, revealing brief stakes of rust. In others, ice and sunlight turn the constraint to electric white lines of energy. Farther up, past buried landmines and anti-tank posts of corroding concrete, up in a pillbox netting and sod, halfway up the cliff, young Dr. Bleeg and his nurse Ivy are relaxing after a difficult lob. His scrubbed and routinized fingers dart in beneath her suspender straps, pull outward, release in a sudden great smack and ho-ho-ho from Bleeg as she jumps and lands not too hard to squirm away. They lie on a bed, faded old nautical charts, maintenance manuals, burst sandbags and spilled sand, burned matchsticks and unraveled cork tips from cigarettes long decomposed that comforted through the nights of 41 and the sudden rush of heart at any glimpse of a light at sea.
You're mad, she whispers.
I'm Randy, he smiles and snaps her garter again, boy and slingshot. A line of cylindrical blocks cripple the silent king tigers that now will never roll the land chains away like so many white muffins across the dun pasture, among the low patches of snow and the lime outcrops. Out a little pond, the black man is down from London, iced improbable as a zouave, riding his blades tall, dignified, as if born to them and ice, not desert. Small towns children scatter before him, close enough to have their cheeks stung by curved wakes of powdered ice whenever he turns. Until he smile, they dare not speak, only follow, tag, fronting the smile, fearing it, wanting it. He has a magic face, a face they know. From the shore, Myron Grunton and Edwin Treacle, both chained, brooding over Operation Blackwing and the credibility of the Schwarzkommando, watch their magic Negro, their prototype, caring to ping Fen or any style in front of these children. The winter's in suspense, all the sky a bleak, luminous gel. Down on the beach, pointsman fishes a roll of toilet paper, each sheet stenciled, property of HM government, from a pocket nose. Roger now and then pushes hair back under his cap. Neither speaks. So the two of them, trudging, hands in and out of pockets, their figures dwindling, fawn and gray and a lick of scarlet, very sharp-edged, their footprints behind them a long, freezing progress of exohars, thing from the glazed beet white, we have lost them. No one listened to those early conversations, not even an idle snapshot survives. They walked till that winter hid them, and it seemed the cruel channel itself would freeze over, and no one, none of us, could ever completely find them again. Their footprints filled with ice, and a little later, were taken out to sea. In silence, hidden from her, the camera follows as she moves deliberately nowhere, long-legged about the rooms, an adolescent wideness and hunching to the shoulders, her hair bluntly Dutch at all, but secured in a modish upsweep with an old tarnished silver crown, yesterday's new perm leaving her very blonde hair frozen on top in 100 vortices shining through the dark filly. Widest lens opening this afternoon, extra tungsten light laid on, this rainiest day in recent memory, rocket explosions far east now and then visiting the maisonette, rattling not the streaming windows but only the doors in slow and fourfold shudderings, like poor spirits desperate for company, asking to be let in, only a moment, a touch. She's alone in the house, except for the search cameraman and Osby Feel, who's out in the kitchen doing something mysterious with a harvest of mushrooms up on the roof. They have shiny red-orange cut patches of whitish-gray veil. Now and then, the geometry of restlessness brings her to pass in a doorway at his boyish fussing with the Amanita muscaria, for it is this peculiar relative of the poisonous destroying angel that claims Osby's attention, or what passes with him for attention. Flash him a smile, she means to be friendly, but which to Osby seems terribly worldly, sophisticated, wicked. She being the first Dutch girl he's ever spoken to, he's surprised at finding high heels instead of wooden shoes. Struck, in fact, a bit witless by her so groomed, and he imagines continental style, the intellect behind the fair-lashed eyes or dark glasses effects out on the street, traces of baby fat, the dimples countersunk each side of her mouth. In close-up, her skin, though nearly perfect, is seen to be lightly powdered and rouged, the eyelashes a touch darkened, brows reshaped a matter of 2 or 3 empty follicles. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.